Internet Informed, Guidance for the Dedicated Searcher, as read by the author, David Novak. This book is an element of The Spire Project. Chapter 7, Attention. Observe everything. See detail where lesser mortals merely trample by. El Capitan's advice rang through his head as he mentally prepared for this challenge. Albert led his small party to the door of the Cistercian Abbey de Fontfroid to gather aid. Left unresolved, he feared a simmering conflict of words would escalate. Minor incidents of interfaith violence would grow more serious, more frequent, perhaps into armed conflict. He prayed for peace. Through careful questioning, Albert learned the new emissary from His Holiness Pope Innocent III inspired some of this violence. Meeting him would be a most delicate confrontation. Barging into the long 60-foot dining room, Albert strode purposely to the head table to confer with the abbot. Would the abbot please help persuade the visiting dignitary to act with more discretion? Help convince the papal representative to mind more carefully the potential conflict between the Holy Roman Catholic Church and the emerging faiths of the Langue d'Oc. Nothing could be gained by conflict, much would be lost. Few in the room held significance. Some present were not nice indeed. The church abbeys and their extensive estates had long been run as a separate nation within a nation, where the abbot could pardon criminals, disregard taxes, and certainly ignore the demands of a civil representative like him. Albert stood on uncertain ground. After a lengthy and animated discussion, the abbot agreed only that Albert indeed stood on uncertain ground. The abbot declined to help. In a brutal time when concerns for community safety quickly overrode any sense of personal rights, Albert worked as a police detective, unencumbered by rules of conduct. Perhaps fitting, then, that we should now delve into the detective's talent of observing the world and recognizing truths others would overlook. Some would call this the Sherlock Holmes approach to searching, but this skill is much too simple to suggest only a detective of Holmes's caliber can perform it. I gaze out the window and across the countryside as I drive west from Melbourne. There is such variety in the landscape, and I wonder why I so rarely look at the scenery. Perhaps my mind is too clouded. I think of the destination, not the journey. I once disregarded the internet the same way. I sought my destination, caring little of the journey. In the process, I overlooked the hallmarks of quality, how information has history, how information competes for my attention. I overlooked so much of importance. When we focus only on our destination, we rip away the foundations and isolate the surroundings. We lose much of what makes the fact valuable. The image of this is a page ripped from a book placed before us. Starved of detail, all we see are the words on the page. We see nothing of the author, the context, its place in a book, or indeed if it came from a book, magazine, or newspaper. We encounter this information in a raw state, stripped of all context. Do we read it? Do we pause to gather background? In the words of Alain de Botton, author of many a book on modern philosophy, n'allez pas trop vite, don't go too fast. And an advantage of not going too fast is that the world has a chance of becoming more interesting in the process. Busy people do not have the time to do what they are doing, Alain laments. Search the internet, plow towards a destination, race for some paragraph or fact. Do we leave time to do what we are doing? Allow ourselves the luxury of an interest in information, and we have a chance to notice the internet's structure and organization so important to gathering comprehensive guidance and judging trust. These emerge only when we give the information an opportunity to tell us, when we take the time to notice. Alas, if we go too slowly, searching becomes recreation. Appreciation for appreciation's sake is enjoyable, but not productive. While we may wish to divert our attention to investigate a publisher, to ruminate on the popularity of a website, to forage for link companions and synonyms and such, what can we do quickly? I have shown how context and prominence can be simplified to little more than a click on a bookmarklet. Let us now address the many clues that already flash before us, demanding only our recognition. We need only to make them explicit, act like a detective, open our eyes, see what is already before us. We will cover two particular skills in this chapter, URL interpretation and a constant awareness of our question. Together, they reinforce an attitude of attentiveness to the subtleties and nuances of the internet world. Deep URL interpretation. Every item published anywhere on the web has an address. This address combines words and symbols, country codes and the names of organizations, acronyms, conjunctions, file names, and perhaps even coded information to be interpreted by software. It's all there for us to see. Any internet user can gaze at an address and notice the two-letter country code and perhaps the name of the organization responsible for the website. To the experienced searcher, the web address may suggest quality, format, date, publisher, type of author, and more. Let us tease apart this address and learn as much as possible, keeping in mind that with practice, this will come to take all of 4 seconds. The address also serves as a foundation around which we lacquer our experience with internet information. Over time, we build an accurate expectation of the types of information residing on .com sites. We begin to know what we will find on personal websites, on serials, on web pages named index.htm. Since we see the web address even before we visit a resource, we have the added incentive that an address may convey something of the quality, topic, and depth before we spend any time retrieving the information. Watching addresses, we will learn to skip over a great deal of the information unlikely to be valuable to us. In all cases, the address becomes the steadying staff we lean on so as never to feel quite so lost, quite so far from home. As we travel, read the signposts. We are not just somewhere on the net. We are in a given country, on a website of a given organization, reading a particular perspective as established by a given author and publisher, all of this encoded in the address. We are not lost at all. We are precisely here. What do we mean by web address? In this book, we continually use the term web address and URL almost interchangeably. Strictly speaking, there is a difference, in that the URL, the Uniform Resource Locator, can point to information placed almost anywhere on the internet, including newsgroups and FTP sites. The web is just one of several kingdoms on the internet, though a most voracious kingdom with extensive ties to all others. A discussion list is strictly not part of the web. It is not accessed with the web's HTTP protocol, except that discussion lists often escape and become lodged on the web for all to see and search. Almost all messages to newsgroups have web addresses if we invoke Google Groups, the grand search of newsgroup discussion. The tool invoked to access an item of information is no longer so significant, with the exception of some of the newer tools like BitTorrent. Once, tool was of paramount importance. The distinction between FTP, web, and newsgroup were many and meaningful. As we have discussed, the concept of format now holds more value. How was the information originally prepared is more meaningful than what does it look like now. To my mind, the term the web has lost most of its precision in general conversation. It has largely absorbed the term URL. This is not to negate all differences, for the internet can, at times, mean any of three different concepts: a physical network of computers, a logical cyberspace realm of information, and a social community engaged in communication. The web only ever refers to cyberspace. In this book, we continually use the term web address, URL, the web, and the internet interchangeably. From a searcher's perspective, the differences are simply no longer significant. I labor this point because many search guides take pains to clarify these differences, dwell on more significant matters. What does the web address look like? The URL contains many parts. Each part has meaning. There is the internet protocol, the domain name, directories, file name, and file type. The domain name of spireproject.com/cn/bellafor.jpg has a host name of www, a domain name of Spire Project, and the type of organization, a .com. The country code is absent. The domain name is further broken down into four pieces: a host name, domain, type of organization, and country code. At the far left, we have the tool. This is usually HTTP and means a web page. It can also be FTP, Telnet, News, HTTPS. Each tool defines the way the information is presented. Thus, HTTPS establishes a secure connection. FTP presents the information as a list of directories and files. If the tool is absent, it defaults to HTTP. The next in line is the domain name, broken into several pieces and read from right to left. At the highest level, most right, we may have a country code. If the domain name comes from .ie, the page comes from Ireland. .fr means France, .au means Australia. When there is no country code, as in the address above, it indicates the US, unless it is a .com, in which case it could be anywhere, since we see them scattered all over Ireland, France, Australia, and the US. SpireProject.com is hosted in the US, but I could host it in Australia easily enough. The next element to the left of the country code describes the type of organization involved. .com, .edu, .gov, and .net translate as commercial, educational, government, and network resources, respectively. The use of .edu and .gov are strictly controlled. Others are less formal. Anyone can own a us.com, for instance. Newer extensions like .info and .biz also exist and have a meaning. They're not common yet, so for a time, they primarily mean the .com site was occupied. Some of these rules vary by country. In New Zealand, we see .govt instead of .gov. In Ireland, .com is dropped entirely. In England, .ac for academic replaces .edu. Rules governing the purchase of domain names vary too. The Australian .com.au addresses go only to Australian businesses with a claim to that name. Remember, we can easily restrict our focus to sites with a specific organizational element. Add inurl:.gov to any search request, and we now only review pages with .gov in the web address. Show us just the government web pages, we ask. inurl:.au reveals Australian websites, or rather, those sites with .au in the address. A search that includes inurl:.gov.au is certainly allowed. Subtraction works too, though removing all .com sites by including minus inurl:.com is rather clumsy, and I recommend against it. The next element in the domain name should tell us the organization involved in hosting our webpage. For spireproject.com, a commercial effort calling itself Spire Project is somehow responsible. Trust this name. The website is found on a computer assigned to them. On rare occasions when this name is altered by hacking or spoofing, the change is usually obvious. If we find a file on worldbank.org, we are, without doubt, reading a World Bank document. With one major exception. The use of .com sites can be confusing. Worldbank.com is not the UN's World Bank institution. Harvard.com is not Harvard University. Whitehouse.com for years was a porn site. This affects .com sites almost exclusively, since even a kid down the block can register the generic .com. By the way, there are simple and established methods to change the ownership of misleading domain names. Just buy the domain name, or with a little more effort, assert trademark infringement through the Uniform Domain Name Dispute Resolution Policy, UDRP. The part of the domain name that appears first is called the host name and tells us the specific entryway to the computer involved, the name of the host computer. Often, there is only one host computer, called www, standing for World Wide Web. This standard emerged back before it became clear almost all information would migrate to the web platform. Once we had gopher.well.com, ftp.well.com, and www.well.com. Today, we usually drop the www, though the occasional address still requires it. Spireproject.com is the same as www.spireproject.com, and any publisher with a domain name should ask their internet service provider, their ISP, to make sure the host name is unnecessary, almost certainly a free service. On occasion, we may see different host names. For example, www2.xyz.com translates as the second World Wide Web computer, most likely because the first became very busy. Sometimes the host name corresponds to a department within a given organization. health.wa.gov.au translates as the health host computer of the Western Australian Government of Australia. By the way, the domain name is always case insensitive. Capital letters make it easier to read, but do not affect the address in any way. Publishers should use this to their advantage. Directories and file names, however, are case-sensitive. Capital index and lowercase index and all capitals index.htm are different files. Following the domain name may appear one or more directories. Then perhaps a file name and file type. These elements may not be included and, if absent, simply lead to a default page for that given address. Thus, pages may have multiple equivalent addresses. Spireproject.com is the same page as www.spireproject.com/index.htm. At other times, each frame and graphic has its own address. We can reach a page, yet view it in a way not intended by the publisher. Directories and file names. As we reach beyond the domain name, the first important lesson is that a real, living person named, arranged, and designed the website in a way useful to them. It is someone's hard drive. We're not working with computer-generated names. There are standards, habits, and conventions in how websites are designed. Directory names, for instance, are used to organize information by topic, by project, or on rare occasion, by date or alphabetically. Never randomly chosen, directory names help a real person remember their contents 2 years later. Thus, /database/statistics/today.htm almost certainly means today's statistics for the database. Just read right to left. We often encounter acronyms and contractions within an address. A contraction for FinPub is simply two words smashed together, losing many of its letters. Found on a financial page, FinPub almost certainly stands for financial publications. Remember, it means something to the person who named it. The number of directories tells us something, too. Find a web page buried 5 directories deep, and we have reached a very specific project. With few directories, we look for something more general and of general importance to the publisher. There is a special case for the page at the very top of the directory tree. With no directories and no file names, this page is the initial doorway to the organization. It is a brochure, intended to present the organization in its best light and in beautiful graphics. Think introduction. Think sales literature. Do not think content. Another special case involves the tilde symbol leading the first directory. This is a long-standing default for web addresses provided by an internet service provider and roughly indicates a personal web page. More precisely, it indicates a loose connection between the author as titled after the tilde and the organization responsible for the domain name. A loose connection is not a tight connection. For instance, my ISP provides me with free web space at inet.net.au/tilde-spire, a part of the inet's computer but set aside for Spire. Next, consider the file name. This name means something to the publisher. We name files to help us remember their contents. If a file name has a number in it, like page03.htm, then certainly page02.htm, page01.htm, and perhaps page04.htm exist. The top page of a directory is usually named index.htm or html, content.htm or html, or home.htm/html. This page links to most, if not all, of the pages in that directory and also links to any subdirectories. We may not know what we are looking at, but we know we will see the contents of the directory from there. File types, like .htm or html, both mean web pages, .jpeg, an image, .ppt, PowerPoint presentation, .doc, document, .pdf, secure document, and more tell us how the page is presented. This, in turn, may tell us something of its contents. Finally, some trailing information is for interpretation by software. As I understand, this pertains only to text following a question mark. This information is broken into separate variables, each separated by the ampersand. A Google search, for instance, may have the address google.com/search?, q=inurl.com.ie/num=40. The program search at google.com is handed two variables, q and num. The ampersand separates each variable. With redirection scripts, many times the true address is one of the variables. Yahoo often redirects addresses, as seen in the following rather cumbersome address. Notice the destination address at the end. In summary, the address is a string of pearls identifying the contents of a given web page for the benefit of the author and publisher. The domain name suggests the publisher's identity and, through that, something of the content and quality. Directories and file names tell us something of the content and sometimes format. We read the address like a sentence from right to left. Most addresses are incredibly easy to read. In 1997, I first published the Information Research FAQ, accepted as a recognized network FAQ, and archived at www.faqs.org/faqs/internet/info-research-faq/part1/. Do not skip over this address. It's all there. We are reading something from faqs.org, an organization devoted to FAQs, no doubt. It deals with the internet, since it is in a directory called Internet. Info-research-FAQ probably stands for Information Research FAQ, and this address leads to part 1, so we know the FAQ is in pieces. We read this address like a sentence. Try another. defense.govt.nz/publicdocs/defensepolicyframework-june2000.pdf. Again, like a sentence, it's all there. The New Zealand Government Agency for Defence is publishing a public document probably titled Defence Policy Framework. It is a PDF document prepared or released in June 2000. I'm reading this only from the address. The essence of deep URL interpretation includes one final task, speed. Remember, we're attempting to read the address in 4 seconds. Quickly digest the web address and describe the contents. Try to be precise, but also try to reach beyond what we know for certain to state what we only suspect to be true. Persevere with this, and it will be a great ally in our search for information. Practice in URL interpretation. Let's try our hand at some of the web addresses I use in my seminars. Look closely at each address and describe the resource before you read on. First one is 1. worldbank.org/data/dev/devgoals.html. Looks like the World Bank to me. Good publisher, reputable. This file seems to be talking about data and dev. Dev for the World Bank probably means development. Dev goals, development goals, but particularly data for development goals. I say it is a document with statistics describing the development goals of the World Bank. This page contains development indicators for poverty, education, and gender equality and the like, arranged by country. In short, it is a page of standardized statistics describing country development. 2. eia.doe.gov/emeu/cabs/contents.html. A tough one. The country code is missing, so this must be from the U.S. government. DOE would be the Department of Energy or the Department of Education, perhaps. EIA is a subdepartment of the DOE. We know this because they have their own computer. We're looking at it in the directory of the EMEU, probably a project of the EIA, and CABS is probably a project of the EMEU. Thus, the CABS of the EMEU of the EIA of the DOE is doing something, and we will look at the contents page. I have no idea what's involved, but this project is specific, very specific, since it is buried 4 levels deep in the U.S. government hierarchy. It will interest us or not. This page is a collection of country analysis briefs, CABS, describing energy needs and production statistics by country. It comes from the Office of Energy Markets and End Use, EMEU, of the Energy Information Administration, EIA, of the Department of Energy, DOE. 3. www.geocities.com/coliseum/arena/4336/fire.html. GeoCities is a free web farm, a place that offers free web space to anyone who asks. Fortune City, Tripod, and Angel Fire are others. The directories Coliseum, Arena, and Seat 4336 just describe how the web farm organizes their directories. All we really know is that the author has placed this information on free web space, that they do not have somewhere else to put the information, and that this information has something to do with Fire, the chosen file name. Having said this, it must be unimportant enough for the owner to risk losing it, since free web farms sometimes implode and disappear. This webpage is dedicated to the memory of Bandit the Fire Dog, who worked at the Chicago Fire Department, and is accompanied by a very personal and passionate look at local firefighting history. 4. www.chef.ac.uk/tildeis/publications/infres/6-3/infres63.html. This is a serial, a repetitive publication like a magazine or journal. Notice the 6-3? This cannot be a date. It shouts serial, Volume 6, Issue 3, especially since it's somehow tied to Sheffield University in the UK. The /is may suggest a personal website, but I know a few personal websites with directories called publications. The contraction infres probably comes from the title, too. I say this is an academic e-journal tied to Sheffield campus, but not an official Sheffield publication. If it was a Sheffield publication, it would have a directory that does not start with the tilde. It will almost certainly contain quality peer-reviewed articles with an academic edge. The Information Research e-Journal, an international electronic journal, is published by Professor Tom Wilson of the Department of Information Studies, University of Sheffield, in association with further professors from Finland, Singapore, the U.S., and Lithuania. The address now forwards to a new domain, informationr.net, established for this publication and other work involving Professor Tom Wilson. 5. members.inet.net.au/tildeholmgren/truth.html. Holmgren, either a person's name or an organization, has a website on an Australian ISP, a network resource with members. Yes, certainly an internet service provider. This probably means this is a personal web page or a small business not yet owning a domain name. We will shortly read The Truth. If we found this page through a search engine, the title The Truth About September 11 would accompany this address. Clearly now we are looking at a highly personalized interpretation of those events. I find no intrinsic reason to trust such advice, no reason yet to consider this anything but biased hearsay, so I would avoid it. Having said this, it offers a strangely compelling reading. 6. www.chooseindia.com/tourism/gujarathistory.html. This page probably comes from either the US or India, since the generic .com site does not identify a country. The domain name suggests to me either a commercial travel agency or just possibly a government site that promotes tourism, a site like visitvictoria.com or newzealand.com. If chooseindia.com is not the nation's official tourism site, then I expect little depth, little historical accuracy, and an uncomfortable bias. Choose India Travels publishes a fine and beautiful brochure, much like any brochure about India found at any travel agency. This page contains about 10 paragraphs on 3 tourist sites near Gujarat. Hacking a web address. Before we leave this idea that web addresses tell something of their contents, let me show you a simple technique of hacking a web address to reveal nearby information. Usually hacking means taking an axe to something, chopping off a chunk of wood to burn in a fire. Here we chop off the file name, and perhaps a directory, to reveal a page located nearby. On other occasions, the address to a nearby page is simply obvious. Our aim is to alter the address directly. Say we land on a file that reads wicked_ideas.com/jokes/page14.htm. Obviously, there is a page13.htm and probably a page15.htm. Page 2 will look like /page2 or /page02.htm. We can further say that since there is a directory set aside for jokes, there are probably other directories set aside for other wicked ideas. We can have a look by visiting the directory above us. When we hack a directory, we may find chopping off the end of the web address directs us to a default page for that directory, usually the index.htm or HTML, or home.htm or HTML, a page that describes the contents of that directory. On occasions, this will generate an error message, in which case we may simply wish to guess the page we want is called index.htm. This next address points to a directory of international governmental organizations on the website of the Northwestern University Library. library.northwestern.edu/govpub/resource/internet/igo.html. Let us find other documents within this website by directly hacking this web address. Chop off the file name igo.html, then press return, and we reveal a page describing the purpose of this directory. It links to internet/igo.htm, as well as internet/foreign.html, a directory of foreign government websites. Chop off another directory, and we reveal a web page that lists the many government resources this library has prepared for us, including various electronic collections and information about staff and opening hours. Chop off another directory, this web page, titled Government and Geographical Information and Data Services, introduces this depository library. Chop off all the directories, and we reveal the homepage for the Library of Northwestern University. We travel this path back up the hierarchy of organization, simply by making short, sharp chops with our axe. Highlight the portion of the web address we want to remove, type delete or control X, then press return. Little effort, little fuss, we hack the web address. Sometimes we will hack a directory and receive an error message that says we are not allowed to view the page in question. This is the time to guess there is probably an index or home page in that directory. If all the pages are ending in .htm, so will the index or home page. If all the web pages end in .html, so will this one. A few websites mix .htm and .html. This scene gets a little more complicated if the web address includes .asp or some computer variables, but the concept holds throughout. We can alter our web address ourselves to find nearby information. I wanted to see a movie last year, so I looked at the reviews of The Da Vinci Code and Slither on my favorite review site, RottenTomatoes.com. I first looked at www.RottenTomatoes.com/m/Da Vinci Code. In a simple guess, the next page I want will be RottenTomatoes.com/m/Slither. File names are selected to mean something to the person who names them. Directory names are selected to organize information in a way that will be obvious 2 years later. Use this to our advantage by hacking the web address. Keep in mind the context bookmarklet is more useful under most circumstances, but this is just one more way an understanding of the URL can assist us. Predicting content with URLs. Let me state clearly, deep URL interpretation is an excellent search skill. It is sound, fast, and very helpful in directing our attention profitably. If we do not want to look at a travel brochure to India, we do not visit chooseindia.com. Or we visit only long enough to determine it is not published by the Indian government. Certainly, you may be clumsy at first, willingly interpreting web addresses and projecting far-fetched expectations where they do not belong. However, with time and a little practice, deep URL interpretation works splendidly. We look over a list of resources and instantly see which ones are most likely to have the information we seek. A new image of the internet now emerges, where we see the internet ahead of visiting it. Suppose we ask Yahoo to recommend some prominent material on a topic that interests us. We can now predict our way to the information we seek, discarding vast quantities of information merely because we suspect it would not treat the topic in the manner to our liking. Instead of reading titles, when I look at a search engine results page, I read web addresses. Addresses tell us more. Did you know we can ask our web browser to flash a link's address in the bottom edge of the web browser whenever we move our mouse over a link? In Explorer, select View Status Bar. This allows us to hover our mouse over a few links and see their destinations. Oh, this link is to an article in the New York Times, this link to a personal web page, and that link to the organization's website. Even if the page we are on tells us nothing of this in words, we can read it from the web address of the link. A central theme in this book is the gradual reconnecting of elements found in cyberspace with their corresponding elements from away from the internet. Field searching is the author title search of the library catalog recast for the internet. Format applies to the internet just as it applies to books and articles. URL interpretation is another such situation, another bridge. This predictive power tied to the address greatly resembles our predictive power for information in the real world, a world of magazines, brochures, and phone books. We know what we will find when we visit the reference section of a library, or approach the help desk of our local government council, or call the media department of an international corporation, or reach for a local paper in a coffee house. Each place is a touchstone around which we build our expectation. If this resembles our earlier discussion on format, you are most certainly correct. Experience extends beyond format to destination, author, publisher, and whatever else we find. Anyone who ever reads a tabloid will never forget the experience. Welcome to the Sherlock Holmes style of attentiveness. Holmes counts stair steps. He listens to the footfall. He invites Watson in just as he pauses to knock on the door. Sherlock Holmes is addicted to heroin and has traits of an autistic savant. To each their own. However, if Holmes were to visit the web, he would certainly notice the web address. Holmes also displays a second skill we need to rediscover, an ability to ask the right question at the right time. Attentiveness to our question. The question is not what you look at, but what you see. Henry David Thoreau. We reach for the internet and begin a search. Sometimes we have a clear question in mind. Sometimes we have only a vague need to explore. Till now, we have assumed we generate our question with ease. This is a typically naive approach, and one I shared for many years. Unfortunately, in assuming we know our question, we miss four generous opportunities. Firstly, our question is our flashlight, illuminating what we see. Ask a better question, we get a better answer. The gulf between a good search and an excellent search often simply depends on the elegance of our question. Secondly, our search tools respond best to certain kinds of questions. We can phrase a question to gather better information from a search tool. We have already encountered Boolean, proximity, and field searching as a way to draw better answers from a global search engine. We can also frame our question to make use of prominence. The commercial database responds best to lengthy, precise search queries rich in the use of descriptive fields and a thesaurus. On a discussion list, demonstrate we have searched and ask closed, answerable questions. In each case, we ask our question in a way suited to our search tool. Thirdly, as we build our question, we establish a dialogue with the world of information. This is the elevated vista we will discuss further in Chapter 9. What do we think exists? What will it look like? Where will it pool? Answers to questions like these allow us to refine our image of the Internet and to answer further questions, questions like, is this all the information we will find? Should we give up looking? And what will the best information look like? Fourthly, questioning is the essence of a search, the most enjoyable aspect of a search. There are few prescriptions for crafting questions. This is pure art. We follow hunches, explore the information wilderness, and work with nebulous concepts, delicate nuances, and notions of the possible. Jump over this step and we give ourselves little time to be artistic. A non-trivial search is a journey. We draw from our experience, from our knowledge of the available resources, and from our artistic soul. This voyage has a start, a middle, and an end. In the process, we establish a dialogue with the Internet. As a search develops, our understanding of the topic, our expectations of what we will find, and our frustration will gyrate wildly. As we journey, we continually ask many questions both of the information we encounter and the destination we draw towards. This questioning is also central to quality assessment. Who is this author? What else have they published? Is this work prominent? These small questions fill the interlude between grander questions we ask not of the information, but of our voyage. Are we getting the sort of information we prefer? Are we missing something critical? A wooden sailing ship of years gone by tacks back and forth towards a destination, making the most of favorable winds. We decide the night's anchorage and route. We negotiate the open water, the inshore reefs, and the storm that breaks upon us. Only the armchair admiral, drinking port by the fireplace on dry land, would dare simplify instructions as sail to Gibraltar. A non-trivial search behaves the same. We have many thoughts to consider as we move towards our goal, especially when our goal remains uncertain. Our goal may simply be find some monkeys in Spain, or plan a lovely vacation near Barcelona. When we start our journey, there is no way we can state our question precisely. We do not know that Gibraltar, with its many Barbary macaques, its many rock apes, will be our destination. To suggest we should not change our question mid-search is like nailing jello to a wall. Rather messy and not particularly productive. Our search will move beyond Spain, certainly well south of Barcelona. Journeys are lived. It is true a brilliant general may try to plan a battle before it begins, but they would never dare leave the battlefield without leadership as the battle rages. Too many decisions must be made that cannot be envisioned in advance. Librarian friends of mine always recount how we start with a general question and progress to more specific questions. I am hard-pressed to express my dissatisfaction with this approach, but I remain uneasy. Sometimes we start with something that only at a stretch would we consider a question. We may start with a vague interest. During the search, we continually alter our approach, asking wildly divergent questions and questions about questions, meta-questions like, are we finding the information we want? Are we wasting our time with this approach? Is there a simpler way to proceed? And then there is my personal favorite, shall I ask a librarian for help? A little girl with pigtails approaches a librarian at a public library. Excuse me, she says in a small, squeaky voice, I'm looking for something about trees. Please, someone hand her a picture book. What just happened? The little girl's question is simply best answered this way. We look at her needs and skill and then make a simple judgment. We correct her question with a better question. Where do I find a picture book about trees? Next, an aging carpenter approaches the desk asking for help saving a tree he just mistakenly cut in half. We can correct this question too. Where do we find a helpful tree surgeon to converse with? This next step so totally defines our search. We will no longer wander in the dark, looking at the whole gamut of resources, commercial, public, internet, from books to articles and beyond. We have narrowed our search rather precisely to just that area we expect to find an answer that will satisfy us. We want a colorful picture book and a talkative tree surgeon. This happens time and time again in searching, at so many stages in our journey. Our search becomes a string of questions. Each question hopefully brings us a step closer to our eventual destination. or if not, then confirms an avenue as unpromising. About 5 years ago, I demonstrated some search techniques for Trade New Zealand. We sought marketing background on an unusual resource. Side by side with another researcher, we looked through the internet for information that would help. My searching was not particularly better, and pressed for time, my results were severely limited in scope. However, I asked the right questions. At one point during the search, my mind wandered from the quest for information to the quest of who had such information. Could another New Zealander have tackled this question before? Could we make contact? Adding a quick inurl:.nz limited my current search to just New Zealand domain resources, and a .govt.nz resource easily caught my attention. It demanded my attention, actually. Yes, another New Zealand government agency had completed an extensive project on this very topic just a year earlier. Ask the right question, reveal the right information. There is a degree of mental dexterity and horizontal thinking that lends itself to this skill, as Sherlock Holmes would surely instruct us. This skill starts, however, by being attentive to the questions we already ask. A complex search is not just a quest for the right information, it is also a quest for the right question. Notice what I am suggesting. Above our search for information rests another search we should take equally as seriously, a search for the right question. Search without concern for our question, and we will probably find the information we initially desire. However, we will completely fail this second search, the search for the right question. I may well find something of interest on an obscure commodity for the New Zealand Department of Foreign Affairs, but I would never tap the far greater experience of the government-funded expert I eventually uncovered. For that, I had to ask a better question. I had to ask if someone else was at hand with the experience I needed. We must make this second unspoken search audible. Feedback. Let us revisit surfing for a moment from the perspective of a search for the right question. We approach a search engine and allow it to bring to our attention what it computes will interest us. The search engine returns a list of 20 or so web pages. If we do not find the information in the first 20, we are invited to look at the next 20 based on the same flawed selection criteria. Say we notice no useful matches. Perhaps the list is skewed in the wrong direction. Perhaps we are missing the voice of a type of publisher we thought would have more to say. Our search failed. Do we really want to start adding additional words and search engine punctuation? It might help, but we do not want a better failure. We want success. Feedback offers this possibility. Find one page that interests us more than others. Look at this page and try to decide what it is that interests us. Look for key concepts and phrases that might describe what we found. Look for the publisher and author. Perhaps the format set this page apart. Now use this information to craft a better search or to justify searching somewhere else. We feed back what we learn into the next question. Feedback picks up on this idea that a search proceeds on two levels. The first level, a hunt for an answer, masks the second level, the hunt for the right question. If our search fails to reveal something of our answer, why not try to find the right question instead? All that is required is that we notice the questions we are asking, then try to ask better questions. Further along the journey, as our search gains resolution, we will go back to searching an answer armed now with a better question. I have a delightful demonstration of how a search proceeds on two levels, and it goes like this. How do we find the cheapest airplane ticket to Paris? Think about it. This is a tough question. The answer? Ask how to find cheap airplane tickets to Paris. Then work from there. The best answers often come from asking the best questions. Intentionally imprecise. Two further search techniques make good use of the newly found attentiveness to our question. The first approach involves varying our questions in small steps instead of trying to leap directly to a very precise question. Need help with a damaged tree? We need an expert. Experts congregate in mailing lists. We know there must be a directory of mailing lists. Let's start there. We sidestep some of the difficulties of using either a tight telephoto or a wide-angle lens by slowly zooming into our target. The advantage is simply that by stepping slowly, we have a better grasp of the questions we can ask. We should never be in a situation where we dump words at search engines and say, "Tell me something about fish breeding," a hopeless question of little value. Equally, we are not ready to ask the more specific questions until we know more about the information landscape we will search in. We can also be intentionally imprecise in such a way that we capture information we know only a little about. A page is missing. If the page moved, we could search for just the middle part of the web address on the assumption the page moved to another computer or the computer was renamed for administrative reasons. A person's name, in quotes, does not reveal who we thought we would find. Perhaps we can allow for a middle initial. An Australian search for a website fails. Perhaps its web domain does not end with .au. Can we be imprecise about the country code? We search for a Brisbane hotel in the suburb of Redcliffe. Brisbane Hotel Redcliffe. No luck. So we drop Redcliffe and search again. Too general. We drop Brisbane and learn that Redcliffe is not, in fact, a part of Brisbane. It's a nearby town. Lastly, we have an intriguing way to be imprecise, which we will explore further in Chapter 9. Instead of searching for a critical page with the information we seek, perhaps we want to search for the neighboring page, the page next door. In an internet where perhaps 10% or 20% of the web is indexed, we may never find the information we seek because the page is not indexed by our search engine in the first place. However, turn our attention to the page next door, the page that describes the report or introduces a directory or describes the many projects produced by an association. These pages often attract more links and are more likely to be indexed, and on occasion are easier to search for. In the simplest of examples, some full-text articles referenced by the PubMed medical database can only be approached through PubMed, not directly. Being imprecise may be our salvation. We will take many steps as we ask questions, and our questions will lead us first one way, then another. We will backtrack and try again when we get lost. We will clarify our search, and we will build better expectations of where we want to go. At the end of a complex search, we usually see just one or two questions were pivotal in our success. Our other questions merely set the environment for these pivotal questions to emerge. However, none of this will happen smoothly if we do not listen attentively to the questions we are asking. Pay attention. We have covered a great many aspects of information in this book. Many subtle and minor relationships exist and add structure, color, and clarity to the information we encounter. By this point in this book, we have good reason to consider the internet as resplendent in structure, color, and clarity. To help reveal this, we have continually shown internet information is similar to non-internet information. We noticed how format applies to the internet and non-internet information alike. Format is a fundamental aspect of all information. Format drives content, to a degree. We drew our attention to the importance of the publisher in internet and non-internet information alike. Publisher identity is a fundamental aspect of information, too. Publisher identity drives bias as well as content, to a lesser degree. We also looked at quality, at prominence, at structure. All these non-internet phenomena apply equally online. Well, we finally reach a point where we must break away from bridging experience we learned elsewhere and start building our own reservoir of experience from our time online. Yet even now, we can copy, since we want to build our experience in a very similar way to how we build experience with non-internet information. I find science books by science writer Paul Davies less interesting than science books by Professor Stephen Hawking. In fact, I generally prefer books by scientists about science, though I prefer books by journalists about conflicts in science. In a similar way, industry insiders write business books that excel at revealing the inner workings of an industry, and I love them intensely because they answer certain questions candidly, which outsiders are loath to mention. Questions like what an industry will look like in the future. I intensely dislike the ramblings of blogs, an online diary of sorts, just as I dislike mailing lists with a great deal of traffic, unless they can be word searched. Today's popular computer magazines and news media seem to adore blogs, but they have been wrong before. They pumped push media and many of the minor search engines. They loved meta search engines long after I thought little of them. This kind of advice is hearsay. Such personal feelings, ungrounded in any in-depth analysis or study, cannot be trusted. However, these mere suppositions and expectations form a body of experience that guides me around the internet. Oh, I abandon this experience quickly enough when an alternative suggestion arrives, but I do listen to this experience when the internet is quiet. You too will form this kind of experience. Dislike rambling blogs? We will not ask for them. Love insider books? Let's go look for them. Lost our way? let us ask how to search before we proceed. If it works with cheap airplane tickets, perhaps it'll work on a next search as well. Make the most of this kind of experience. Actively build this experience from your own suspicions and expectations. Hang this experience on the URL and the questions we ask. On the internet, more than anywhere else, we persistently encounter apparently new information presented by apparently new sources. If we do not see this as an opportunity, if we do not see our previous experience with similar organizations and similar questions as relevant, then we will mistakenly assume we have little experience to draw upon. This only enhances the lost-in-space experience we may feel on the internet. However, it is with our attention that we turn this situation to our advantage. Yes, we have never encountered this publisher before, nor have I asked this question, but we have encountered similar publishers, similar formats, similar motivations. We have asked similar questions. Mindful of the web address and mindful of our question, we build onto our reservoir of past experience. Even Sherlock Holmes would applaud.